Welcome to the Senate Human Resource Committee, and I look forward to your presentation. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a great opportunity to be able to talk about public health topics and the work that we do to protect and improve the health of Iowans. What I'd like to do for you is take you through a broad overview using the slide packet that you should have in front of you of the novel coronavirus or COVID-19 outbreak. And it will be relatively short. If you have questions as I go through, please do feel free to interrupt me, and certainly any questions that arise towards the end, I'd be happy to discuss. So with that, I think we can start, and I apologize, let's get all these organized here. I think we can start by discussing some of the basics of this. So we're talking about a virus that is a new or novel type of coronavirus. Coronavirus is a family of viruses, and it's responsible for a growing and expanding global outbreak of respiratory illness. This virus has been called a couple of different things since it was first noted in December of 2019. Again, it's a member of the coronavirus family. It has subsequently been compared to prior coronaviruses. I'll discuss that in a bit, but you might have heard it referred to as SARS-CoV-2, but the language that we're largely using in public health, we're referring to this as COVID-19. I know that's a bit confusing. Those are all the same thing, and moving forward, I'll be referring to this as COVID-19. So to be very clear, there are currently no cases of COVID-19 here in Iowa. And the risk here in the United States and here in Iowa does continue to remain low. But I want to talk with you about what has happened so far and the type of public health preparedness work that we do in case we should have cases that start to be transmitted among the community here in the U.S. or here in Iowa. So again, right now, the general public is not at risk to this virus because it's not circulating in our communities. But what we've recognized in conjunction with our federal partners and global partners in public health is that as other countries have seen sustained community spread of this virus, the potential does exist for spread to occur here in the United States. And this is precisely the kind of thing that we want to prepare for. So, again, to be clear, anytime we have the emergence of a new virus that's able to infect people, this is a serious public health concern. But I want to emphasize that this is precisely the kind of concern that public health works very closely with our local, state, and federal partners to prepare for. So if we turn now to your background slide, I'm going to give you just additional information about coronaviruses in general. Something that I think has been a little bit challenging at times to communicate is the fact that, as I mentioned, coronaviruses really refer to a family of viruses. They're so named because the particles on the outside resemble a crown, the Latin corona. And in fact, we know that coronaviruses as a family can infect both humans and animals. There are actually 7 coronaviruses that can infect humans. Now, of those 7, 4 are actually very common. They cause mild cold-like symptoms, and in fact, most of us have probably had one at some point. We see these typically circulate during our respiratory viral season, which we are still in. And so these are sort of common illnesses, common viruses that we know of. Now, in addition to those 4, there are 3 more rare viruses. Those are going to include viruses that are capable of causing more severe disease. That's going to include SARS, MERS, and the new COVID-19. So again, keeping in mind that coronavirus is a family, COVID-19 is going to refer to this new virus. All of these coronaviruses are typically spread through what we call droplet transmission. So that means, people who cough or sneeze and expel small droplets of liquid that have viral particles in them that would then land in the eyes or mouth or nose of somebody else. And that's typically how we believe these types of viruses move from one person to the other. And if you turn to your transmission slide, what you'll find here is what I'm alluding to in general with these viruses. So initially, when this particular virus, COVID-19, was identified, a lot of the cases seemed to be associated with a particular seafood market in Wuhan City, China. And so the working theory is that this represents a virus of zoonotic origin, meaning it moved from the animal world into the human world, which we know can sometimes happen. And so initially, we really thought that this was animal-to-human spread. Now, subsequently, we've seen that this virus is capable of moving from person to person, which is important to keep in mind. So we do now know that this is a virus that can move from one person to the other. And in fact, outside of China, we've now seen upwards of 30 other jurisdictions reporting cases of COVID-19, including the United States. I think it's also important to recognize, and again, I'll talk a bit more about this in a moment, in addition to the spread that's been noted first in Wuhan City, then in Hubei Province, and then in mainland China, there are now also a handful of other countries or jurisdictions that are reporting community spread. If you turn to your next slide, you'll see a global map, indicating countries where cases have been reported from. Again, there's approximately over 30 other jurisdictions that are reporting these cases, including the United States. If you turn to your next slide, you'll see some of the travel guidance that I was referencing in terms of specific advice around certain locations. So the CDC issues what they call travel notices, and they do this for a variety of things. For example, they would have done it for Zika, things like Ebola or measles, to help travelers understand if you're going to a particular place, what things you might look out for. Now, currently, CDC has issued a level 3 travel notice for two jurisdictions, China as well as South Korea. This means that CDC recommends that people do not travel to these jurisdictions at this time. There are also level 2 alerts in place for Iran, Italy, and Japan, and this is recognizing that those jurisdictions have reported community spread, and the advice from CDC is that, for example, older adults and those with chronic medical conditions would consider postponing their non-essential travel at this point. And finally, related to COVID-19, there's a level 1 travel warning with relation to Hong Kong. And for this travel level, the advice is that it's not that travel is not advised, but that you can practice usual precautions, but be aware of the cases that have occurred in this particular jurisdiction. And I think I would take this moment to highlight something that you'll probably hear me say a couple of times, which is that part of this response, I think one of the hallmarks of this response is that things have been changing quickly, and so you might have seen these travel notices evolve over time, and that may continue to happen. If you turn now to the next slide, what you'll see is a demonstration of the tables from CDC, and it's indicating the cases of COVID-19 that have been identified here in the United States. And there's going to be two tables here, and CDC sort of adjusted their approach to reporting this towards the end of last week. And their reasoning in doing this is because, again, as I'm sure many of you have seen, there have been a couple of approaches that are being taken with regard to travel and this particular virus. So the top table is indicating cases that were identified in individuals who reported a travel risk. That was 12 cases. And then we saw two additional cases that represented spread from a case who had traveled to somebody who was a close, intimate household contact of theirs. So that's a total of 14 cases that we're referring to with relation to travel. Separate from that, CDC is listing cases that they have identified among persons who were repatriated to the United States as part of efforts at the federal level in conjunction with the Department of State and HHS to help assist Americans who were in China, getting them back into the United States. This group is being sort of reported on a little bit differently because their risk was a little different. We knew that they were in a high-risk area, and it wasn't unexpected that there was going to be a portion of these individuals who would likely become ill. And so the differences in reporting are trying to reflect differences in risk in these two groups. So if you turn now to your next slide, you'll see similarly the tables that we're sharing out of the Iowa Department of Public Health. I'll take this opportunity, and again, I'll repeat this a couple of times. We're trying to share as much information as we can, as quickly as we can. We want people to know that they can visit our webpage to receive up-to-date and reliable information. We've got a lot of resources on that page that I'll point to, and there's resources included at the end of your packet that you can visit or direct others to, things like resources for businesses, schools, and healthcare providers. So again, we want to make sure that people are aware that this is a reference that they can visit. So with regard to these two specific tables, you'll see the top table is titled People Being Monitored by Public Health. So this is going to refer to individuals who had travel to mainland China within the past 2 weeks and who we are providing public health monitoring for to make sure that they're doing well in good health and not developing symptoms that would be concerning for a potential COVID-19 illness. And so these numbers will be adjusted over time as we hear about new travelers. The number will be increased, and as travelers complete their two-week monitoring time period, you'll see them then go into that completed section. And this information is statewide. And we'll continue to provide updates on both of these tables every Monday, Wednesday, Friday on our webpage. The lower table that you're looking at is the individuals who we have tested for COVID-19 here in Iowa, and you'll see that we did test two individuals for COVID-19, and those test results did come back negative. And we will again continue to update those numbers every Monday, Wednesday, Friday on our webpage. So with regard to testing, I know, again, this is an area that there's been a lot of interest and attention to at the national level. So currently here in the United States for Iowa, the only testing that's available to detect COVID-19 is done through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, I'm sure many of you are aware that the CDC has been working very closely with partners like APHL, the Association for Public Health Laboratories, to make this testing available to state public health laboratories. And there was an effort, and there are efforts continuing to be made to do this. Initially, in the process of state labs validating the test kits that they received, there were some errors noted. And again, this is part of why we have our labs validate these tests. And so CDC is now reissuing those kits. And so again, currently, the option for testing for COVID-19 at this point needs to be done through the CDC, but we are awaiting a test kit that will become available to our state hygienic laboratory here in Iowa. Yes, I'm so sorry. Is that better? My apologies. Is there anything you'd like me to repeat at this point? Thank you. So as I mentioned, we're awaiting a test kit that our state hygienic laboratory should receive. And to give you an idea of what that testing would be, we're talking about probably a swab here that's going to be in the nose and then in the throat is what the testing looks like at this point, sort of similar to a strep if anybody has ever received one of those. And in terms of the turnaround time, I'll tell you that it probably will end up depending a little bit on the volume, which makes sense, but we're expecting something on the order of several days at this point. I think I have a final note here for you, which you may or may not already be aware of. There are currently no therapeutics, so no treatments or vaccines available for COVID-19, but I can tell you that there are a variety, and again, I'm sure many of you are aware, there are a variety of research entities as well as industries that are pursuing, therapeutics and vaccines, either on their own or in conjunction with federal partners like BARDA, CDC, NIH, and others. So I wanted to talk a little bit, of course, about prevention, right? Because this is where public health likes to live. If we can at all, we want to prevent you from ever becoming sick. If we're doing our jobs correctly, then nothing happens, which is always exciting, right? So the advice here, and I appreciate that this sounds very basic and simple, and it's a message I'm sure many of you have heard from me or from others before, but there's some very basic but very important measures that people can take. And it includes things like washing your hands thoroughly with soap and water or using hand sanitizer when that's not available, doing things like covering our coughs, making sure that we don't sort of share germs in that regard. And this last one is really important, and we know it's hard to do, but really truly staying home from work and school when you're ill. And we know that that's hard. We know that people don't like to put a work burden on others when they're missing work, and we know that it can be hard to step away or miss things, but it's such a critical thing to do, not just to speed the recovery for your own health, very nice covering of the cough, but also I had to. It was a very nice example. I'm so sorry. But also, to protect others, right? So it, that truly is, again, I know it sounds basic, but it truly is an important measure to take. And the more we can do to support people in doing that, the better. If you turn now to communicating with Iowans, you'll see a sample of an infographic that our public information officer, Polly Carver-Kim, put together. And hopefully you've seen some of these kinds of graphics and messages coming from our website, coming from our partners, our social media, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook accounts. And we're trying to share messages with people on a variety of topics, including things like the basics, explaining what this virus is, explaining how it's different from some of the other more common coronaviruses that I mentioned, and explaining what the risk factors are and what people can do. So we'll continue to be sharing those messages. And again, we're happy to have people assist us in passing those sorts of things on. So I wanted to kind of wrap up here with explaining some of the preparedness messaging that I'm sure many of you have heard coming out of CDC, and from the health department within the past day or so. We want people to think about preparing for COVID-19 just like you would prepare for any other severe weather event or flu season or anything that might affect the health and functioning of your family. And I want to acknowledge that, again, anytime we have something new or uncertain, it can be scary. And there is still much that we don't know about this particular virus. And as we learn more, we're going to turn around and share that information with our key partners and with the public, through the variety of means that I mentioned. But we want people to also recognize that, again, this is the type of work that public health prepares for. And it's not just the kind of work we've been doing for the past several weeks or months. We've been doing this work for years or decades. We prepare by having workforce that's experienced in things like epidemiology, clinical and veterinary medicine, laboratory sciences, and emergency preparedness. We do things like establish and maintain relationships with key partners throughout the state who do a lot of this work throughout their communities. We have things like exercises and drills, particularly around something like influenza, which, again, in the fall every year, you'll hear me and the department share messages with Iowans about how to prepare for flu season. And this is another example of something that will affect your health that we want people to know how to prepare for. And to that end, one of the really important things that we want people to know right now is where to find good information. I think recognizing that information has been coming out particularly quickly around this response, which is good but also presents challenges, is important. And so, again, we want people to know that they can visit the IDPH website, that they can use our social media accounts, and that they can reach out to local and state public health if they have questions and concerns and look to those resources for up-to-date and accurate information. And again, as simple as it sounds, I can't emphasize enough that there are basic things that we can do to protect ourselves and take advantage of to keep ourselves healthy. So this includes things like getting our flu shot if we haven't yet. The flu season is still current. We are still in flu season. It's not too late to do that if you haven't yet. And also taking advantage of, the variety of preventive measures we have to keep us healthy from other illnesses. So staying up to date on your routine vaccines, making sure that you have your regular medicines available to you at home, taking care of your health in general are always important things to do, and not forgetting that those basic measures of covering your cough, washing your hands, and truly staying home from school and work when you're ill sound very basic, but they're very important measures to help keep yourself as well as those around you healthy. So I think that's probably most of what I had for you here. I think your final page is going to refer you to some of the references and information that we've prepared on the website. Again, I would encourage folks to visit that and recognize that as things have changed, we do continue to update that, and that is a good place to look for the latest available information from the department. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Senator Bolcom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Pedotti, thanks for being here. I've been impressed with your early tenure as our state epidemiologist in the kinds of work you've done over your time, and you're going to get a little workout around the coronavirus, it seems like, in terms of your partners. I'm interested in the testing issue.
Sure.
And so you indicated that the CDC is, I think, trying to prepare our state public health labs to be able to do in-state testing.
That's right.
What's your sense about when that might be up and running for the medical community to have a state lab?
If I could give you an educated estimate, I would tell you 1 to 2 weeks, but I would also tell you part of the validation process, you know, is making sure that these tests work correctly. And so, you know, there could always potentially be another challenge here, but several weeks is what we're planning for.
Do people feel like the protocols in that are going to be accurate, I mean, in terms of what the CDC is offering?
Yeah, you know, we've spoken and we continue to speak with representatives from our state hygienic lab every day for updates. They're a critical partner of ours, not just on COVID-19, but for all of the public health work we do. They've assured us that they're familiar with the protocols. They're anticipating eagerly the receipt of these kits, and they're ready to validate it when they get it.
Terrific. So I assume you've been doing outreach to medical providers or hospitals and doctors. Could you give us a little bit of update on kind of the preparation at the medical community?
Absolutely.
Level?
You know, part of what we do in public health is provide support, expertise, and answer questions from those clinical and medical partners. So we do things like share messages through our Health Alert Network system, which is a system that we've had in place for a long time to deliver urgent messages with key information to those partners. We've sent several messages through that system. We do things like host webinars, and regular touch points, not just with our clinicians, but also with our infection preventionists at each of the healthcare facilities.
What kind of questions do they have right now about getting ready?
They ask questions about how to protect healthcare workers, which are great questions. And I can tell you that that is a particular interest of mine. I also serve as the Council for State and Territorial Epidemiologists Healthcare Associated Committee Chair, and so I've been fortunate to work very closely with CSTE and the CDC on helping to support and disseminate that guidance. So we provide that guidance to our healthcare partners, and they're eagerly asking questions, and appropriately so, about who are the patients we should look for, what does the symptoms look for, that sort of thing. And so we'll provide guidance on what are the symptoms, what are the questions you should ask, and when you identify a patient, how do you evaluate them, how do you get testing done. In this case, that's going to involve contacting us at the health department and having those discussions.
Thanks. One final question. So it's really uncertain, it seems like, what this could look like a month from now or 2 months from now, just reading the stories overnight, all the concern about this. Do you have any wisdom or any view on that? I mean, what it could look like, because some of the reporting on this is we could in some places see school closures and cancellation of community events and kind of fairly disruptive.
Yeah, I think that's
Is that a worry for us here?
I think that's a great question, and I think that it's completely understandable and appropriate for people to be concerned, for people to be worried, and I of course wish I had a crystal ball to be able to tell you where we're headed. I don't, but I can tell you this. This kind of event is the work that public health prepares for, whether we're talking about vaping-associated lung injury, influenza itself, or a new virus. These are the kinds of events that we work to prepare for. And so a lot of the plans that we put in place and the tools we use, for example, the things we used around H1N1, a tough flu year, right, a pandemic, those are the kinds of approaches and things that we have at our disposal and the kinds of things that this could start to look like. And when we talk about school closures, and social distancing or avoiding group settings, we recognize that those are anxiety-provoking and stressful things to consider. Again, I would emphasize that there are tools available to us to limit the spread of a virus that moves from person to person. And they're not decisions that we take lightly, but they are things that we want to have at our disposal if we would need to use them. And even though I wasn't here, in Iowa for the H1N1 pandemic, I can tell you that we've been reviewing that experience and the lessons learned. And one of the lessons that I think we and others learned is that we want to have these conversations earlier. The hope is that we never have to implement any of these kinds of things. But one of the things that we want to make sure we're doing is sharing messages, being clear, and making people aware of what we can do well in advance of when we would need to do it.
Thank you very much. Good luck with the second answer.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Mathis.
Welcome, and thanks for addressing our committee. On the transmission page, you talk about seafood and animal markets, wet markets, and the significance of those wet markets in the transference of this virus. How, compared to what we have in the United States, And we hear thousands of people die from the flu every year already in the United States. Compare this spread as an epidemic or pandemic compared to what we have in the United States every year when we see deaths around flu.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And again, I think for a lot of us in the public health world, influenza, you know, often if I'm asked what I worry the most about, I worry about flu. And I worry about flu because it has the potential to change quickly. And every year, as you've said, it causes illness and death, including here in Iowa. And so we use flu often as a model for how we prepare for these things and for what these kinds of things might look like. And you're right, you know, for us here in the United States currently, influenza is a more common virus. It has unfortunately caused illness and death here in Iowa already this season. And so far, we haven't seen community spread of COVID-19. And so right now, flu is very much more the more pertinent threat. But I think, again, it's a model for how we think about a virus that could move through a community. And there are a few things that I think these two have in common and some places where they differ, right? We're talking about respiratory illnesses in general. So again, the idea that if I cough or sneeze and I'm close to somebody else that I could transmit it that way. You know, that's similar to how we see an influenza virus move. And so a lot of the public health control measures that we use for something like flu are applicable for COVID-19. And again, I realize this sounds overly simplistic, but truly things like covering your cough, washing your hands, and staying away from other people when you're sick are effective measures for viruses like this that can move from one person to another. I think your questions along the lines of a pandemic, you know, it's interesting. You know, we use in epidemiology, you know, some language to describe what it is we're seeing. So you'll hear us talk about things like outbreaks or epidemics. For me, those are functionally the same. You know, you might get slightly different answers from slightly different epidemiologists, but what I'm considering outbreaks or epidemics, those represent regional increases above a baseline of an illness, right? And that's going to differ depending on the illness you're talking about, the time of year, you know, and that sort of thing. So that's what I think of when I think of an outbreak. When we think of a pandemic, we're talking about, you know, an illness that has now increased above baseline and has spread across the world. And so you've probably seen some people refer to criteria that we use to evaluate a pandemic. And we talk about a new virus, a virus that can spread from person to person, and a virus that has demonstrated sustained community transmission across the world. And so that's why, you know, likely you've seen organizations like the World Health Organization highlight, as well as the CDC, highlight the fact that this is not yet meeting the criteria for a pandemic, but we want to recognize that the potential for this sort of thing is there. And that's why you'll hear us say that while the risk here in Iowa is low, and it is, we want to acknowledge that situations like this or viruses like this do have the potential to spread. And this time frame, you know, the time, you know, where we have to think about these things and share these messages is exactly when we want to be preparing. We want people to hear these messages and understand where to go for information, what this means, and what response looks like well in advance of when we would have to take those actions.
One more follow-up. Doctor, I just noticed in a bill that we may be debating on the floor at some point, and it's on pharmacists' ability to give vaccinations over the, you know, different types of vaccines and things like that. But I noticed in the bill it also made reference to any kind of epidemic or pandemic to lift those restrictions on pharmacists or other medical professionals to allow them to do their work during that point of time. What else do you need us to do legislatively to prepare for something that might head our way? Is there anything that you can think of that we should be doing now legislatively?
You know, that's a great question, and I would ask if I could maybe think about that and perhaps follow up through Amy McCoy, if that's okay. You know, I think it's a great question. I think recognizing that we do already have a variety of mechanisms, as you've highlighted, in place for ways that we can use the workforce and the resources that we have if we should need to. That includes folks like students or trainees, right? Thinking through ways that we can get additional assistance and support here here in Iowa from the wonderful resources that we do have. I think right now, you know, my biggest ask, you know, of anybody, you know, across Iowa, again, is I want people to understand a new virus that makes people sick is serious, but we do work to prepare for these sorts of things. We want people to understand that this is the kind of thing we've done work to prepare for and will continue to prepare for. We want people to know how to get accurate information and look to us for that information. And we truly want people to really implement these basic measures of taking care of themselves.
Thank you very much. Senator Carlin?
You know, these things kind of scare the heck out of people. Do they have any kind of a handle on what the mortality rate is?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I can tell you that because many of the cases have been in China, a lot of the data so far has really come out of China. And it sounds like, based on the World Health Organization site visit earlier this week, they're seeing a mortality rate maybe around 1 or 2% within the sort of Hubei or Wuhan area where that was really the epicenter.
Okay.
But outside of that, they're seeing something lower, more around 0.7%. Now, okay. I also have to caution you that you know, I'm receiving these reports sort of through the general reports that the World Health Organization would issue, mm-hmm. just like anybody else. And I think it's important to realize that when you move from one jurisdiction to another, one country to another, there may be mm-hmm. slight differences in how we define a case, for example. And so that might affect, you know, your numerators and denominators. And what I'm trying to convey is that we have some information, but I mm-hmm. think there's still, unfortunately, much we don't know. And mm-hmm. so as things continue to evolve, as we learn more and as there's more information, some of that may change. But right now, it's looking somewhere in that range.
It's about 1%. Okay. How does that compare to SARS or MERS?
Those were a bit higher. Those were closer to 10%.
Okay. So.
And I think that's an interesting, you know, I'm sure you've heard us, and we have, you know, and by we, I mean the public health community. We've used SARS and MERS in many ways as sort of a framework for this particular virus. And in a lot of ways, I think that's appropriate and makes sense. I think we're also learning, as we do with any new issue, that there may be some differences. And something that's important about this COVID-19, I think, is that there's much more of a range of illness with this COVID-19 than we've seen with SARS and MERS. So people with SARS and MERS tend to be really quite severely ill. And for whatever reason, it appears that this COVID-19, there are some people who have very mild illness, you know, which we know coronaviruses can do, right? But it appears that there are some who have mild symptoms and, in fact, you know, recover and do well at home. So, again, I think that's going to be, as we get more information, an important piece of how we respond, because it likely will not be that every person who would get this virus would require high levels of care. It's entirely possible that there's a range here and that some people may just need to stay home and recover.
Did they develop a vaccine for SARS or MERS?
There have been some attempts to develop vaccines around those two, you know, particular viruses. They're not widely used, and I don't believe any of them would have been through our official vaccine process here in the United States, but I can double-check on that and get back to you. I think it's still experimental. But we've also seen some approaches with using therapeutics that have been trialed around SARS and MERS, so some antiviral medicines that have been tried around those viruses are also being tried around COVID-19. And again, some of that work is just still in development and remains to be seen, you know, how those will sort of develop and what will work. And again, you know, I know that this is, I want to acknowledge, I know that this is hard. I know this is frustrating, you know, and I know things are moving quickly and there are things that are tough about that. But I do think this is actually a good example of how really the global public health community is working together on these sorts of things. And, you know, to develop a vaccine to prevent people from becoming ill would be great, right? That's our goal. Again, anytime we can take advantage of a preventive tool, you know, something so that you never have to get sick, it's a wonderful thing to be able to do.
So one of the questions I guess I have is, if you were to get this, if there's a respiratory infection, you know, some of the treatment modalities we have here commonly in our hospitals in the United States, like racemic epinephrine to keep the airway open,
yeah,
things like that. Do we have any kind of Like, would those commonly used treatment modalities that we have in the U.S., would those help in the treatment of these of cases?
Yeah, you're right. So things like the RAC-EPI treatments or supportive care, fluids, you know, that sort of thing are the kinds of things that are being approached around these cases because we don't have anything yet specific to COVID-19.
Right. And that 1% figure, that's China. They don't have the same kind of access to those things that we do. Our batting average would probably be way better than the Chinese on this.
I think that's an important point. Again, I think it's important to recognize this is something that the global community is working on. There are variations jurisdiction to jurisdiction depending on how they're counting cases, depending on the therapeutics they're using, even variations in things like nursing staff. There are some countries that don't have professional nursing staff available the way that we do, and so they're not as well equipped with infection control practices as we are. And so there is variability. And again, I know that it's hard. I do think there's still much to be learned about this.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Edler.
Thank you. And I've got to ask, is it Dr. Padotti?
Yes, you've okay. got it. That's perfect.
Thanks
it's a lot of vowels.
Today.
I apologize. You've got it.
A very big issue. You know, as I look at this, when it says suggested animal person, or from suggesting animal to person, have we verified or confirmed that there is a zoonotic state of this?
Yeah, that's going to be really hard to do to sort of get back to that point in time where we could really prove, you know, the exact moment that something sort of moved.
Of the current strains that are showing up in the U.S., do we know?
Yeah, so when we look at viruses like this, the genetic analysis that's been done so far, again, it's hard to prove sort of the exact moment and way that this happens. Genetically, it looks like there's a bit of a bat influence here, which we know we've seen with other illnesses. And sometimes, you know, and again, we have a public health veterinarian who is very well versed in this and has explained to me that sometimes, especially with animals like pigs or others that are genetically similar to humans, you have the potential to mix some of those genetic components or adaptabilities. And so it's possible that a virus that's around a lot of animals might then start to evolve to learn how to infect humans a little bit better. And that's how we think these kinds of things move from an animal to a person. Additionally, with regard to the genetic analysis of these viruses, for the most part, countries have been making these genetic sequences available publicly when they've been recognized. And it appears that there are not big differences between what's being seen in different parts of the world, which is suggesting that there aren't many changes happening at this point.
Thank you very much, Senator Edler. Senator Sigebart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Doctor, for being here today. This is very timely, by the way. There's a bit of a panic running out in Iowa already. I went home last weekend in western Iowa and was hit with this question, and there's all kinds of rumors floating around. So who is the authoritative source now that we should rely on for the best information? Public health or?
Yeah, we okay. want you to reach out to us. We want you to look to us. You know, we really want you to feel confident in knowing that your Department of Public Health is a trusted and reliable resource on this.
Second question. I got several. Rapid fire. If right. Senator Sweeney has this and she sneezes on the table, how long does that stay effective? I mean,
yeah.
Does it have a time limit before
yeah.
it dies?
I did have H1N1. Does that make any more comfortable?
Great question, and again, you'll hear me caveat things with there's much we still don't know, but I can tell you that coronaviruses in general are not particularly hardy viruses. So, for example, we're not worried about things like packages, mail. There's no risk associated with that sort of thing. And the advice that we provide, for example, in a healthcare setting for people who would manage these patients are that any EPA-approved cleaner, you know, for the appropriate surface would be appropriate for a virus like this.
Short, quick question. Do our flu viruses, for the most part, come from China, or do we make those here?
Flu viruses are fascinating. There's a variety of types of flu viruses. You hear us talk about flu A and flu B. Flu A is an area where we sometimes, again, see overlap with animals. Poultry, birds, pigs, these are areas where in the past we've seen overlap or movement from the animal world to the human world. And that's, you know, a possibility at any point in any place. Flu B viruses are the other type that you'll often hear us talk about, you know, that can be moved from person to person. And at this point, it appears that flu really has a seasonality, you know, and that's exactly why we sort of make adjustments to those vaccines every year and encourage people to take advantage of those. So it's not necessarily that they come from any one location. They have the potential, you know, flu is unfortunately a smart virus. It has the potential to sort of move and emerge at different points in different times. You know, H1N1 was really recognized here in the U.S.
Okay, thank you. What's the best effective antiseptic to use if you're cleaning your house or your bathroom or wherever you're at?
Yeah, again, take a look at those labels. You know, the things that are sort of EPA approved, and they'll sort of tell you what they're EPA approved for. And in fact, we've got links on our website that sort of help you go through all of those if you have specific questions. But depending on the surface, right, whether we're talking about wood or tile or glass, you know, and depending on, you know, what you're preventing or what you're cleaning up, you know, there's some variations, but there's plenty of available appropriate cleaning agents.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Yoakum?
Thank you, Madam.
Just a couple questions. Thanks for being here. What's the incubation period mean? Once I've been exposed, what is the incubation period, number one? And number two, what would be your advice to all these young people here who want to get into the health industry or health profession, and give them your best pitch on why they should be a part of the public health system?
I would love to do that. That sounds great. With regard to the incubation period, you know, again, as I mentioned, we're using what we know of other coronaviruses to inform our response and approach here. We're using 14 days, which is what we've seen for other coronaviruses. Now, I can also tell you that some of the early literature that we've seen on some of these cases suggests that it's actually maybe more around 5.8, might be a median somewhere in there. It might be as short as 2 days. But 14 is really what we're using to inform a lot of our approach right now. And again, I have to caveat it with, you know, we do still have much to learn about this virus, but that's sort of the time frame that we're using here.
Compared to like SARS and some of the other...
That's exactly what we use for those, and so that's sort of why we're using the 14 for COVID-19. Yeah, you know, I would first say, you know, congratulations on what you're doing now. I think this is such an important job. It's such important work. You know, I would tell you that whatever you end up doing, please keep public health in mind. Even if you don't decide to go into a career in public health, I hope that what you'll find are that public health professionals can be great partners to you all. Your local health departments and state and federal public health agencies are there to support you, and we want to hear from you. We want to hear about the challenges and experience that you have, and we rely on our clinical partners like you all to let us know when there's something new going on. So you're really valued members of, you know, protecting the public's health across the board, whether that just means working with us occasionally or serving on a public health board or providing guidance or insight based on the work that you're doing. And I would say, you know, speaking as a clinician to clinician and sort of how I ended up doing what I'm doing today, you know, I'll be honest, I always thought I'd work in infectious disease in adults, and then I realized kids are much more exciting and much more fun. So I became a pediatrician, and I loved it, and I love taking care of kids. They're wonderful. But I realized I was seeing the same problems in my kids day after day, and I wanted to find a way where I could have a little bit of a broader impact, broader reach. And so I've been incredibly fortunate now that instead of, you know, treating the patient in front of me, I get to sit here and help support and treat 3 million patients here in the state of Iowa. So if you're considering at all public health, please do consider reaching out to your local and state health department. We could always use more people.
Thank you very much. And Senator Dotzler, you will be the last question because she needs to move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for allowing me to speak. I'm no longer a member of this committee, but I have been here for many years prior. Doctor, just a couple of questions about, I know that Senator Yoakum talked a little bit about incubation, but one of the things that I'm kind of concerned about is when you have an asymptomatic person. You do have an incubation person within that, but they're not showing any symptoms. I believe in the science that I know that they could still transmit, right? That's correct?
It can be.
And so that's one of the problems with this, you know, identifying it. And I noticed on your report that we had seven people with that you monitored with asymptomatic, no symptoms, and then you monitored 30, but we did test two. So that would tell me that you are actually testing some people who don't maybe show symptoms, but are probably in a high risk area. Is that what I'm reading here?
And, you know, I apologize if that's not clear. The individuals that we tested met federal testing criteria, which means they did have symptoms.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, those people were exhibiting signs and symptoms consistent with potential illness, and they had the right epidemiologic risk factor. That was travel, right? So that's still what we're looking at. You're right. There have been reports and concerns around whether or not this virus has the potential to spread from individuals who are asymptomatic. And again, you know, and I know this is hard, I would say this is an example of a place that we don't quite have enough information yet, but it's something that we're working together, you know, as a global and national community to learn more about. And things like this can be complicated, you know, and again, as I'm sure you know with your background, a lot of the testing being done for this is molecular-based. It's PCR-based, meaning we're detecting pieces of DNA. And when you do that, it's hard to know if the DNA you've detected is capable of causing problems, you know, causing symptoms in someone or not. And that's a diagnostic and clinical challenge that we have, not just for COVID-19, but for a variety of illnesses. So I think it's an important thing to keep in mind. I completely agree. As we learn more, there will be more information that we'll share and highlight for our healthcare providers. You know, but I think we just need to gather a little more information on that.
And just a couple of questions about, you know, preparedness. You know, one of the things about the Capitol is it seems like every plague in the state comes through here, and we shake everybody's hands. One of the things that everybody, we've got steep stairs, you know, and the handrails, you don't want to tell people not to grab the handrails because they could fall. But I do know that there are places that have stations that actually have the alcohol-based disinfectants before the stairs. And you can take and put them on your hands, and then if you're using the stairwell, you're also spreading that, not the, necessarily the germs, you know,
sure,
the viruses,
your hand sanitizer coating.
But you're actually disinfecting the stairs. So maybe that's something that we ought to consider at the Capitol here, because I'm worried about my colleagues. And then the other thing is masks. Now, you know, in certain areas, people use a lot of them, and they don't use them very long. They throw it away. Are we trying to build up a supply of masks here in Iowa? And then I do know that they stop two of the three spots you can get it transmitted. They don't help your eyes any, but do they? That really are they more for the expelling of droplets than really to stop it, because I watched across the room and I saw seven different people, including myself, touch their eyes because my eye itched, and I thought, oh my goodness, here I go. And so I just wondered about your preparedness,
sure,
not only for the mask, but also on antibiotics, because we've recently learned that almost 90% of our antibiotics come from China, and they're using it up at a very high rate. So,
yeah, no, these are all great questions, Senator. And I would say that, you know, part of what you've highlighted about the appropriate use of hand sanitizer, again, that's a really important message that we want people to be aware of. And the more people like you, leaders like you, share that, emphasize it, and demonstrate it, the better. We want people to understand the appropriate use of these things, to not do things like touching your eyes, to remember to wash your hands after you've been shaking hands all day, or before, you know, wash your hands before you're eating. Those are all really important things to do, and I'm glad that you're highlighting them and calling them to attention. And certainly if there's anything that I or the department can do to support you or make these things more available, I think that's a conversation worth having. So yes, absolutely, using those things is very important. Your question about masks and personal protective equipment, it's a great one, and it's a question that we've been discussing now for a while. So when we think about using equipment to protect ourselves, there's a variety of different types of masks that are appropriate in different settings. I think you're referencing, surgical masks or Thai masks. Sometimes they're used in other countries even to protect against things like pollution, so it might not always necessarily be tied to a particular pathogen. But right now, there is no need and no recommendation for people in the general public to be using masks. What's far more important is for them to follow those three basic steps that I outlined, and those are going to be important and effective ways to keep themselves healthy. With regard to masks or supplies in a healthcare setting, it's a little bit of a different situation. Healthcare providers do things like take swabs or, get closer to people where they could be coughed on, and so we do have very specific advice about the kinds of personal protective equipment that they should be using, and we do ask those, we're asking our partners throughout the state to give us updates on their supplies, and we're monitoring that in conjunction with our national partners to assess the needs, particularly as we're still in flu season. So recognizing that that's an important thing to keep an eye on, and it is something that we're monitoring at the state and federal level.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Senator Dotzler, I keep some of that sanitizer, either my clerk or I have it, during the day. So a little suggestion there. Yes. Well, thank you so much for taking your time out and educating.